Actually, you can be seated for a moment, and then once we're, I go over a few things, then you can come up to the podium. Thank you. All right. Well, good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We are recording the oral arguments here today. An audio recording will be available on our website within the next day or two. For purposes of the recording, today's date is April 12th, 2023. I'm Judge Cochran, and with me today are Judge Wheelock and Chief Judge Siegel. The first case on our calendar today is Teresa M. Hintz, hopefully I pronounced that correctly, versus Karen Hazy, and hopefully I pronounced that correctly, Chad Hardwood, and Dale Hazy, among others. Appellants will have 15 minutes for your initial argument. Respondents will have 15 minutes for your argument, and then appellants will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. At the start of your argument, I'll ask that you please pronounce your name and your client's name so we can get that right, and let us know how you'd like us to refer to you this morning. The podium is adjustable, and there is a clock showing the time on the podium, so you can keep track of your time in that manner. Counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court, counsel. My name is Patrick B. Steinhoff. I represent appellants Terry Hintz and John Rotter, and we're here today because they have a pipe underneath their land that they didn't know about when they bought the land because it's 10 feet underground and there's nothing recorded in the public land title records to give people notice that it's there. And the big issue in this case is essentially what body of law applies. And we have two choices. We have the law of interests in real estate, easements, statute of frauds, Recording Act, et cetera. And then we have the other option is the reasonable use doctrine and estoppel, which is the law that applies to surface water. And I think it's helpful. I think the correct way to look at this case is from the perspective of a subsequent buyer of this property who doesn't know about the pipe, because that's relevant to both bodies of law. And that's what we have here. My clients bought this land in 2010 out of foreclosure. It had belonged to Terry Hintz's parents, who are deceased, but she bought it. She did not know about this pipe. This pipe was installed in 1977, after she had left the property, and she did not know about it when she purchased it. So
that's undisputed, correct?
Yes, there's nothing in the record that disputes that she didn't know it. I mean, there's depositions, there's affidavits, there's all sorts of facts in the record, and there's nothing to rebut her testimony at deposition and in affidavits that she didn't know about it. So I think I'd like to focus on estoppel. I think that's where the district court and respondents case breaks down. So estoppel is kind of like the enforcement mechanism for the reasonable use doctrine. So even if one has rights pursuant to the reasonable use doctrine, they're not enforceable without a contract or an easement or something, except through estoppel. And if you look at the district court's order and memo, it's 11 pages long. On page 2, he says that plaintiffs, now appellants, are estopped. And then he says the word estoppel on page 3 when he's summarizing the what's in the complaint, and then he never addresses it again.
So, if I could just interject a quick question.
Sure.
So let's assume just hypothetically that the drainage tile system was disconnected. Wouldn't the respondents here have a right to connect it? I mean, under existing law? I mean, just...
Your Honor, I think...
Next week? I mean, that... So I understand what you're arguing about estoppel, that, you know, there was no promise made, there's nothing to stop here, but under the reasonable use doctrine, which appears to still be good law in Minnesota, couldn't they just say... I mean, that's one of the cases, right, where they actually... adjoining landowners connected to an existing drain tile system, and they were allowed to do that. So does it matter, I guess, that your clients didn't know at the time?
I think it does matter, Your Honor, and I think your question gets at a couple factual distinctions between what we're talking about here and the drainage systems that are addressed in the other cases, and I'll hit that first, because it's kind of... background facts that are important. So this is not surface water. By the time it gets to my client's property, it's 10 feet underground.
But, you know, when you look at the definition of surface water in the case law, why isn't it surface water? Because the water originates on the surface.
It does originally, Your Honor, but it ceases to become surface water a long way away from my client's property. I think...
What type of water would you... How would you characterize the water, then?
It's in a subterranean pipe. It's not on the surface anymore. And I know that respondents are going to say that's too simplistic, but...
Well, but assuming that you're absolutely correct, by the time it gets to the Hintz property, it's no longer surface water. And based on the terrain... You know, surface water wouldn't collect on the surface of the Hintz property. But the reasonable use doctrine focuses on the surface waters also of the adjoining landowners, and they have a right. I mean, it's this old thing about maximizing farmland, I'm assuming. That's my reading of it all. So if and it's undisputed in the record based on the expert witness that this otherwise would be surface water for on respondent's land. Isn't that right? So why does it matter whether it would or wouldn't be surface water on the Hintz's land?
So, Your Honor, another point about this system that I think distinguishes it from the reasonable use doctrine cases is this is not appellant's drainage system. In all the cases, we have somebody draining water on the surface, and the law says you can cast your water on your neighbor's land, and you can channel it. And if your neighbor's land has a drainage system on that land, you can connect it to their drainage system. So that's not what's happening here. This is not appellant's pipe. So I cannot go onto your land and install my pipe on your land and have a permanent right to keep it there.
The pipe was there, though, before...
No, there was no pipe there, Your Honor, I think.
I mean, let me finish my question. Sure. The pipe was there, though, before appellants acquired the property, correct?
Correct. The testimony is that it was installed with the permission of the prior owner, whose name was Bob Morehouse. And it was there from 1977 until today. Appellants purchased the land in 2010. So the pipe was there. It was underground. You couldn't see it. These people didn't put anything down in writing. They didn't record anything in the public land title records. There was no way to know that the pipe was there. So I think the only way that they would have a right to keep that pipe there is through the law of easements, which...
What case do you think most strongly supports your view that the reasonable use doctrine doesn't apply in this situation?
I think we'll look at the Kral versus Bosch. I think the guy's name is, I don't know how to pronounce the parties. I think that is the closest to the fact situation here. And I think it's distinguishable because you had a connection between existing drainage systems, okay? You didn't have somebody going onto somebody else's land, installing their pipe on somebody else's land without easement rights. And going back to estoppel, I think estoppel is very, very important here.
Before you move on to estoppel, sorry. So would it be accurate to say that it's your position that the initial permission given to create the drainage pipe affects how it affects the application of the reasonable use doctrine is that because there was permission given initially, that it doesn't apply at all?
Your Honor, I think that gets to whether there's an easement or not. So if there's permission given, you can establish a prescriptive easement. So there's two ways to get an easement. One is to write it down, easement agreement, and then you record it in the public land title record so people know about it. If you don't do that, the only way to get an easement is by, if you use property for 15 years and it's open and notorious, is the word that's used in the case law, you get easement rights. And here it's not open because it's underground, and getting to your question, it's permissive. So if Bob Morehouse gives me permission to put a pipe on his land, and for whatever reason, we don't write anything down, I can't get prescriptive easement rights because it's permissive. So where it gets to the reasonable use doctrine is you can't have reasonable use without estoppel, because if you read all the cases, I mean, you have rights through the reasonable use doctrine, and then the way people enforce those rights are through estoppel. And here, there isn't any estoppel. The court says there is, but it doesn't explain why. And there's just no answer to why. Why are my clients estopped by something that their predecessor did?
So why do you say that estoppel isn't actually an element? Because it's not one of the four elements articulated in the case law. I mean, estoppel applies if the reasonable use doctrine is applicable, but why do you say it's an element?
I think it's the only way to enforce the reasonable use doctrine against future owners. Or if I do something that you rely on and you can enforce whatever that is against me because I did it and you relied on it, but if it's a third party and they didn't do the thing that you're relying on, how can you enforce your rights against them?
But that's not in the case law. I mean, that's the mechanism.
It's the enforcement mechanism.
But the reasonable use, I mean, it's just the four elements of whether it's applicable, right?
It's not part of the reasonable use doctrine, but it's the enforcement. Like, normal people who did this, they would write something down, and there'd be an enforceable contract.
Yep.
And, you know, I think it's mind-boggling why nobody thought that was something they had to do here.
That's,
I mean, it's just insane. It's insane. But so if you don't do that, and you have a pipe that's 10 feet under the surface and nobody knows about it and you can't see it, then how are you going to enforce your reasonable use doctrine rights except through estoppel?
But does the reasonable use doctrine take the place of the representation? I mean, doesn't that supplant it for estoppel or not? Or why not?
No. I mean, I don't see how anyone can enforce their reasonable use rights if it's not written down like it should be, absent estoppel. And the district court says there's estoppel. You know, estoppel doesn't run with the land. It's not imputable among family members.
So when you say estoppel doesn't run with the land, I'm not saying I disagree with you, but I don't recall you citing any case to that effect in your brief. Did I miss it?
There's no case that says it doesn't run with the land, but the cases do say that the party being estopped has to do something.
Right.
So in order to for my clients to be estopped from doing something, they have to have done something themselves that the other party relies on to their detriment. I think the Ridgewood development case is the main case that everyone cites for the elements of estoppel. And there's nothing that says that that it's imputable. So how can those acts be attributed to her and to him, Mr. Otter and Mr. Hintz? They didn't do it. They didn't know about it.
Doesn't that go back to Judge Siegel's question about does that really matter given under the reasonable use doctrine? If a party has a right to divert surface water under the reasonable use doctrine, it really estoppel wouldn't apply.
Which I think, I think it does apply, Your Honor. And I think, you know, there's no way to talk about this case without getting back to the fact that it's somebody else's pipe installed on my client's land below the surface where they can't see it. So it's just not surface water, and it's not connecting drainage systems like a reasonable use case should and has to involve. It is, my time is up, but it's, if I can finish my sentence.
You may.
It's me, respondents going on to somebody else's land, installing their stuff, and claiming a right to keep it there, and not putting anybody on notice of it. That's easement. It's not relevant or reasonable use at all. So it's not even the law that should be applied here. So
okay, thank you,
Judge Cochran. May I ask one more question?
Sure.
I'd actually like both counsel to respond to this question, and I'd be happy to have you respond to it during the beginning of your rebuttal. But assuming that the reasonable use doctrine applies, is it possible for a use that is reasonable at one point in time to later become unreasonable, and that therefore a legal action could be brought later challenging the reasonableness of that use?
I see no reason why not. I'll think about that
for 15 minutes. Think about that and get back to us. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Counsel for respondents, you can proceed when you're ready.
good morning, Your Honors. Joseph Bromland, and I'm here on behalf of, this is a little bit confusing because of all the different parties and the similar names, but I represent Ronald and Karen Hazy, Bruce and Judy Hazy, and Greg Hazy in this case. And together, these parties own the vast majority of the land in this watershed, which is the reason I'm presenting the arguments today. originally, Mike Tomshi, for Dale and Louise Hazy was going to have 5 minutes, but he thought it was by Zoom, and so I'm going to take those 5 minutes. But just so the court's aware, Mr. Tomshi was going to address the related appeal that the respondents brought, and so my intent is not to address the 541.051 statute of limitations issue. I'll just defer to the pleadings on that issue, just since I wasn't prepared to argue that. So moving along here, as I was getting ready for this hearing, I couldn't help but feel that this is one of those cases where sometimes a matter gets into litigation and it kind of gets separated from reality a little bit. So the case takes on a life of its own, but then we have, well, what's going on in the real world becomes kind of secondary. But an interesting thing did happen in this case back last spring before the parties we're going to argue the summary judgment motions, and that is some heavy spring rains hit the area. It was like 3 inches of rain fell on these properties, and there's affidavits about this in the record if you care to read them. But What happened was the water was flowing over
is
land.
Is this in the record before us? Because otherwise it's not appropriate to start talking about what happened 3 weeks ago.
There are
My
affidavits.
My guess is that it's not in this record. So I think if you could confine yourself to what's actually in this record, we'd appreciate it.
Okay. Well, Your Honor, it is in the record. There's affidavits that were submitted prior to the summary judgment motion hearing.
Oh, well, then you can refer to that, but just not rains that happened 3 weeks ago.
No. It was the spring of 22. So
My apologies. Then.
No.
I thought you said 3 weeks ago. Okay.
No, I'm sorry. So there were heavy rains that hit, and there's water flowing right down the watershed that's at issue here. So it was flowing from the Hazy properties on the opposite side of Highway 25 through the culvert right over the appellant's property and into the ravine. And so it just illustrated kind of in real time what the landscape is here and what the reality of this land is. Now, is there always water flowing over the surface here? No, but that's how the traditional drainage in this area was before it was ditched and then later tiled. But there's no question that there is water flowing through this tile. And even in the fall of 21, when the parties were out there for the inspection, there's a photo that was taken in October of 21, the end of a bad drought year in Minnesota, there's still water coming out of the tile at that time. And so what the appellants have ignored all along is you can take they want the pipe taken out, but they don't have any plan for how you're going to accommodate the water that is indisputably flowing through this tile. And that's the basis for their whole claim, is that there's been damage caused by the water coming through
the
tile.
I think they're saying they don't care. I mean, that there wasn't an issue before, there wasn't an issue, so they don't really care. They're whichever way the water flows, they just don't want this pipe.
Well, if you look at the report, the affidavit and the report of Chris Otterness, it illustrates a whole bunch of problems that would arise if you just take the tile out without making any other accommodations for it. And so that's why this becomes a reasonable use case, is because it's the appellants who want the court to order a change to the system of drainage which has been in place on these lands since 1977. And in fact, that tile had been there for over 30 years when the appellants purchased the property.
Is there any reasonable use case, precedential reasonable use case that you can point us to where the water was diverted through a pipe similar to this situation?
Well, the Kral versus Bosch case, which was just cited by the appellant, is probably the most on point case, because that also involves a case where it involves drain tile. And so,
but it didn't talk about an underground pipe. Correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, maybe you can help me understand. You know, your brief refers to drain tile, their brief refers to an underground pipe. Is there significance to the fact that it's an underground pipe when we're talking about drainage?
I don't think there is any significance, Your Honor, because for one thing, the amount of land that the pipe traverses on the plaintiff's property is quite small in comparison to the rest of it. And so they argue that we don't get any benefit from it because we don't drain into it. But that contradicts the extensive study that Chris Otterness, the respondent's engineer, did in this case, where he said that if it weren't for the pipe, this water would be flowing over the appellant's land anyways. And so you're just taking water that would otherwise be on their property and putting it underground. So that's the only difference.
So is there a fact issue here? It seems like the district court did engage in some fact-finding by brushing off the testimony of appellant that she was very familiar with this land, that she, her parents at that point, property, spent a lot of time on it and never saw any standing water on it. So isn't there a fact issue here? And if there is it a material issue? I mean, because this is summary judgment. And it does seem like the district court just kind of brushed that assertion away, saying, oh, that's a little kid. But that involves some fact-finding, I think.
Right, Your Honor, and I see where you're going with that. However, what the court found is that, keep in mind that on the court summary judgment order, it went through the four elements of reasonable use. And on two of them, it found that the appellants had offered no evidence to support those two factors. And then on a couple of them, the court, and I could go through those here, but we're running short on time, but the court found that the appellants had failed to offer sufficiently probative evidence to support a couple of them. And then I would argue that even if Ms. Hintz's recollections were correct, what she said in her affidavit was that she did not recall a regular flow of water on the property. There's a big difference between that and saying we never saw standing water out there. And I think if you look at the photos which have been submitted in this case, which predate the installation of the tile in 1977, it's insulting to the court's intelligence and to everyone's intelligence to say that that you can't see some sort of a waterway there. I mean, you can clearly see.
Aren't you suggesting that there's a factual question then? I mean, you're suggesting comparing the two. In the photo, there's clearly water, but going back to Chief Judge Siegel's question, is there a question of fact there, given the two different, the competing evidence before the district court?
No, there's not, because Ms. Hintz's affidavit, again, it just said that there wasn't a regular flow of water there. Well, then that was countered with the Chris Otterness supplemental affidavit, where he said his review of the historical photos and the topography would suggest that the flow of water would have been irregular. In other words, there'll be times when it might be dry, if it's a dry year, or you might get a heavy rain, and then it might be flooded. Just like what happened in the spring of 22 when this case was being litigated. And also, that doesn't have any bearing on the fact that there's clearly water in the pipe now. And so how do we accommodate the water that's flowing through the pipe? So it's undisputed that there's water in the pipe. The appellants have claimed all this damage to their property as a result of the water that's coming through.
So, counsel, I think this actually gets back to the question that I asked at the end of your opposing counsel's argument, which is, and this, because it would be, I think it would be a fact issue potentially, if the question is, can a use that is reasonable at one point in time later become unreasonable such that additional fact-finding should occur?
Your Honor, the record would suggest that the only thing that's changed with the tile or the pipe is the fact that it's currently in need of repair, which the Hazies have repeatedly offered to go in and make these repairs, which the appellants have refused. And so the only change would be the appellant's use of this pipe has become unreasonable because they're allowing it to degrade and not operate at its
actually couldn't
efficiency.
Couldn't the respondent's use become unreasonable perhaps by something that they chose to do if they were to instead of leaving it as open ground, if they were to cover it all with concrete, that would change the way that the water flowed over their property. It wouldn't sink in. There would be additional water that would then have to go through the drainage pipe. Or perhaps if climate change is causing more intense and more frequent rainfall, that something could happen that isn't actually something that the respondents have done, but it changes the nature of the water flow, and therefore there's a question as to whether it continues to be reasonable.
Well, there could, I mean, that, theoretically there could be changes, yeah, if they were to, for whatever reason, pave their farm fields, which I don't know why they would do that. then the appellants could make the claim that they've done something which is now an unreasonable use because they are now channeling much more water through the system than they had before. But in this case, again, the only change to the pipe has been that it's fallen into disrepair, and everybody agrees that it's in disrepair, but the appellants won't allow it to be repaired. So their use of the system, the appellant's use of the system, has become unreasonable because they're not allowing it, they're not keeping it in repair or allowing it to be kept in repair. And that comes back to another issue that hasn't been discussed much, is that has it really been established that it's the respondents that own this pipe that's under the appellant's property? It was put in with the agreement of all the landowners, and it's undisputed that Bob Morehouse said, yeah, put it in.
So I've got, this leads to a question of mine, and one thing that's been argued by appellants is that the district court's order imposes no duty or obligation, and there's a lot of land draining over this little strip into that creek or whatever it is. So that's a lot of water coming through, but there's no duty imposed to maintain it. So where does that come from? I mean, what are appellants to do if they feel like the work is not being adequately maintained? If the drainage pipe, if the land where there's sinkholes now, I'm assuming your clients would say it's their obligation to fill those sinkholes and to repair them. How is that then? They have to come back into court and sue for repairs? Do your clients acknowledge that then they have a duty to actually reasonably maintain it? Because that's an issue they've raised and is a real concern here.
Well, the Hazies, my clients, have never refused to maintain the pipe. They would like to go in there and make the repairs, but that's been refused.
So do you acknowledge that under the reasonable use doctrine, given that this is a pipe and not natural drainage anymore, that I don't know if it's your clients anymore or their forebears or somebody, successors, predecessor owners of the property, that along with that goes a duty to maintain it?
I think everyone in the watershed has a duty to maintain the drainage system that the parties have put in place on this property. So this property is completely different now than it was before the tile and the pipe were put in. That's why the reasonable use applies to the appellant's request here, which is to remove the pipe, to change the landscape, and to change the drainage situation that's existed on this property since 1977. And so the appellants under reasonable use just have a natural right to discharge water, just to allow the natural flow of water onto the lower-lying property. That's a right inherent in their property. The water doesn't care if there's an easement or not. The water's not going to stop coming. So therein lies the problem, and the essence of this case is, have the appellants met their burden to show that this requested change in drainage, which is just to yank the pipe out.
Could I ask one more question?
Yeah, and I have an additional question, too. Okay. No, you follow up first.
I was just going to say, so the reasonable use doctrine applies to water. It doesn't apply to people entering land. And so I understand the objection of saying, wait a minute, this goes beyond water. Yeah, there's a natural flow of water, which has been, now channeled through this drain pipe system. But aren't we back to the law of easements then, I guess, when you start talking about people being able to come onto your land?
Your Honor, I think that was a recognition by the district court that your reasonable use, your water rights are not any good if they can't be enforced. And so if you have a downstream owner who's either refusing to keep the system in repair or to allow someone else to keep it in repair, there has to be a mechanism to enforce your water rights. And the court doesn't want people to...
Any case law to that effect, or would we be, in essence, is this an issue of first impression, then, I guess? To your knowledge,
I don't know that there's a case that's directly on point, but I think it's just a natural, kind of a necessary element to reasonable use drainage and the water rights. So let's say it wasn't a tile system. Let's say it was an open ditch. And being from southern Minnesota, I see these all the time. I work with a lot of farmers. Let's say it's an open ditch and let's say a family of beavers builds a den in the drainage ditch, which is actually a quite common thing to happen, and it backs up the water all along the system. If that owner refused to do anything about it, the other owners would say, you're interfering with our drainage. So there has to be some enforcement mechanism to allow that. And it really shouldn't be a problem if you look at real life, if everybody would just maintain the thing. And, you look at, the appellants are looking at this all through the prism of, well, if you were to do this now and you had a lawyer involved and you're coming to this, you're going to put together a shared tile agreement and all this stuff, yeah, you'd probably want to get it in writing and have an easement just so all the rights and stuff are laid out. But that doesn't mean that was always done back in 1977, back when Watertown and Mayer were not really part of the Twin Cities metro area. There's just handshake farmer deals that were happening most of the time. And it's also not a reason to ignore the party's reasonable use drainage rights. It's like I said, this water is not going to stop coming. So there has to be, the appellants have to show more. They have to show a better plan. And maybe there is a different way that they could get the pipe off of their property, but they have to accommodate reasonable use drainage, and that's a different case than what we're talking about here today, because that's not been proposed. All that's been proposed is we chop off the pipe, we yank it out of the ground, whatever happens, happens. And the only qualified expert in this case, sorry.
Kind of following up on Chief Judge Siegel's question, you addressed the maintenance piece and enforcing it, but you didn't really get to appellant's main argument, which was estoppel. So can you briefly address that?
Right, Your Honor, and I was...
And the language in the order stating that plaintiffs and their successors in interest are estopped from interfering with or obstructing the free discharge of waters from the tile drainage system, excuse me.
Thank you, Your Honor. I did intend to get to that, but the time slipped away here. I think the appellants are reading far too much into the word estoppel, and I think where that comes from is the Will v. Bowler case, which is a highly relevant case here. But in that case, I don't think the court was applying equitable estoppel. I think it's just a stop. Maybe it was a term that courts like to use more back in 1942, but it equivalent to enjoin or prohibit. You know, you're stopped from impeding the flow of water because the landowners all got together and created this ditch, and so now everyone's prohibited from interfering with it. I think that's the most likely use of the term estoppel. But that being said, I think it does appear that the Will v. Bowler case applies something like equitable estoppel to landowners in these situations, even if it was their predecessors who made the agreement. When you think about it this way, so the respondents and their predecessors, actually we're just talking about Ron Hazy and some other Hazys who are deceased, they wouldn't have put that pipe in under appellant's land if Bob Morehouse hadn't agreed to it. And in fact, the appellant's version of how this all happened was that the Hazys trenched up to the boundary, and then they went up and asked if they could keep going all the way to the ravine, And Bob Morrow said, yeah, go ahead. So then they went ahead and did that. Had he not given permission, the water would have just discharged into the existing waterway or ditch or whatever you wish to call it that was there. But so after all these years, 45 years or so have passed, the landscape is different now. The ditch is leveled off, either was filled in or just naturally filled in with earth. And so now you can't take the pipe out now without severe consequences. And so the pipe, whether the appellants knew about it or not, that was part of the land that they bought. That was the drainage system that was in place on this land. And you can argue that she didn't know about it. There's an outlet pipe there that they owned the property for 4 or 5 years and apparently didn't notice that there was a draining.
We're basing our review on the record before us. So I think we can, and we're looking at the facts and the evidence in the light most favorable to the non-moving party.
Certainly.
So I don't think we should quibble about whether they knew or didn't know. We're accepting the affidavit in the light most favorable to the non-moving party. So given that, I think you can finish your answer.
Well, I think just to finish that thought, I think Will V. Bowler does suggest that subsequent owners of properties served by drainage systems, which were established by prior owners, are barred by equitable principles from obstructing that system. And in Will V. Bowler, that case came about, I think, over 30 years after the ditch system had been in place. And I know that at least the plaintiff in that case was a subsequent owner trying to enforce what happened before. I'd have to read the case again. I don't know if it's clear if the defendants were the same or not, but you would think after 30-some years that there's probably some ownership change which had occurred. The court doesn't go into that. But
okay.
I think Will
Thank
V. Bowler
yeah.
is a big case.
And I apologize again for cutting into your earlier argument. I just misheard, and I thought you were talking about something that just happened a few weeks ago, so I apologize.
Oh, no worries, Your Honor. Thank you. Okay. Are there any further questions? Okay.
Thank you for your answers.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Helen, you'll have five minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just want to respond to just a few things. Mr. Broland asked you to think about the reality of the situation, and you referenced some affidavits with pictures. None of that is natural. I mean, this pipe is not natural. I think that's the problem here. It's a fixed pipe that doesn't work. So these affidavits and these pictures are pools of water that are coming up from the pipe and causing these giant pits in my client's land.
In that regard, is there any evidence to suggest that the pipe is causing the pits?
It's over where the pipe is. I mean, it's 10 feet underground. Nobody's done any forensic investigation. But, it's a pit of water in the middle of a pasture above a pipe. I think we're inferring that it's from the pipe, and I don't think that's disputed.
But then how isn't it also undisputed that respondents, experts said, oh, that's easily fixable?
Your Honor, I think so first of all, as far as I know, there's nothing in the record that anybody has offered to fix anything. There's tort claims in this action, and that is because my client's predecessor allowed respondents onto the land before their mother died, the trustee did, and they trashed the land, they damaged stuff. They didn't fix, they fixed the pipe, but damaged the land. Those claims are time barred. That's why we have statutes of limitations. But I think the only request...
You don't have a claim for damages in this.
Right. They're time barred.
Case.
They were pled.
No, but now, since. I mean,
since,
what's going on
right
now. Yeah.
I think what I'm talking about is, as far as I know, there's nothing in the record that suggested that anybody has offered to fix anything. except for that one instance that created those tort claims. This is 440 feet of fixed pipe. And the reason this all came up is this used to be a pasture. People are building houses out there now. This all came up because my clients subdivided off 5 acres and sold it to somebody who wanted to build a house. And respondents popped up and said, hey, your house site is over our pipe. Not the site of the house itself, but the 5-acre parcel. So getting back to Judge Wheelock's question, sure, you know, maybe in 1977 and before, when the water was on the surface, it would have been reasonable for that water to come onto appellant's land. But 45 years later, when it's a fixed pipe that's underground that nobody can see, and you can't move it because it's a pipe, it's interfering with the horse pasture, it's interfering with house sites. If it was ever reasonable, it's not reasonable now, and I think that is something that's not fixed in time forever. On a related point, I think, of course, there's fact issues. I mean, my position in this case is you never get to the fact issues because you have all these legal questions that can't be surmounted. But if you accept that the reasonable use doctrine applies, I mean, there's disputed facts all over the place. You talked with Mr. Broland about whether there was a ditch there before or not. That's just one disputed fact. But there's also disputed facts about benefits and burdens. My client doesn't want a pipe on her land. If we could go back in time and undo everything so that this was water coming across the surface and it naturally flowed somewhere, that would be a different story. But right now, the fact that somebody else's pipe is traversing the land, it's not a benefit to her or her co-owner. That burden doesn't outweigh whatever benefit comes to respondents who didn't do things the right way. And at the very least, that's something that it's a disputed fact issue. If you accept that the reasonable use doctrine applies, you can't avoid a trial. It can't be done on summary judgment. So I'm out of time.
I have one more question.
Sure.
So are you conceding that if, in fact, appellant's father had agreed to an open and tiled ditch instead of a pipe, that the reasonable use doctrine would apply and this case would be resolved differently?
No. Well, I'll concede something, but not what you just said. If it was an open ditch, I think there would be prescriptive easement rights. I think the fact that you can't see it is important. I mean, I think if they could see it and knew about it, then I think you get into the easement questions. And then also, I frankly don't know if estoppel would apply if they didn't do anything, but they knew about it when they bought the property. There'd be a much, much better case for estoppel if it was something that was open and obvious and wasn't interfering with, wasn't permanent in the way a pipe is.
So
I can see that they would have a much better case if this was all on the surface.
I have kind of a follow-up question. You focused on estoppel in your argument. The district court's analysis was really based on reasonable use. And the only, maybe I'm wrong, but the only place the estoppel language comes into play is in the ordering paragraph, right?
That's right.
So even if we agree with you on the estoppel argument, we still have to reach reasonable use, because the estoppel language only says that they're estopped from interfering with or obstructing the free drainage of waters from the tile drainage system. That doesn't go to whether or not there's a reasonable use.
So, Your Honor, I think the district court just skipped over a lot of stuff. I mean, he skipped over whether reasonable use applies at all.
And then,
you know, he went into the reasonable use factors, and I think there's a fact issue, but...
So you're making a kind of a different estoppel argument, though, than...
Well, I mean, this was all briefed. I mean,
I understand that. I'm not saying you're making a new argument here, but in terms of the estoppel language in the order, and I know you mentioned that earlier, but the district court did focus on reasonable use. You would agree with that, and you did argue why you think reasonable use doesn't apply, but I guess I sort of...
So I think the district court just kind of skipped over which body of law applies, mm-hmm. and then he got to reasonable use. He resolved disputed factual issues improperly, and then he just ignored estoppel.
And you're saying you don't ever get to reasonable use because of estoppel?
Well, I mean, I think you can say that, there would be reasonable use rights if it was Bob Morehouse in court and not successive owners of the property. I think estoppel, you can enforce reasonable use rights against future owners without estoppel, or against anybody without estoppel. So I think it's part of the package.
Okay, thank you for that clarification.
All right, thank you, Your Honor.
All right, well, thank you to both counsel for your helpful arguments here today. We will, the matter is submitted, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory time frame. Yeah.